Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, and thank you for bothering to download the FlixWise podcast. In case you care to know, I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And joining me today is our hollowed-out shell of a co-producer, Mr. Martin Kessler. Welcome, Martin.
I asked for mayonnaise on my turkey salad sandwich, not malaise, God.
Thank you. All right, and try and top that. Here we go. And currently off in a corner drawing little flowers is Battleship Pretensions, Scott Nye. Welcome back, Scott.
Just living in the land of existential despair myself here in Los Angeles.
Yeah, yeah. I thought you were, like, there's a little bit of a delay here, so it was a couple seconds of silence. I thought that was going to be your thing.
Oh, yeah. I was trying to mimic the end of the movie a little bit. But,
yeah. All right. And we have one more person on the panel today. She could barely be bothered to come, but somehow. Mm-hmm. But I am very excited to announce I have a new roommate. Please welcome to the show, Lillian Holman. Do you prefer Lillian or Lily?
Lily
is cool. Okay, so worry not, listeners. Emma may have been replaced in my as my roommate, but she has not been replaced in our hearts. I think we can probably coerce her into coming on again. But in the meantime, welcome to the show, Lily.
Thank you.
Okay.
I'm glad to be here.
On today's show, we have the 73rd film on the Sight and Sound International Critics Poll, Michelangelo Antonioni's L'Eclisse. Scott, last time you were here, we discussed Jean Eustache's The Mother and the Whore, if I am not mistaken.
You are not mistaken.
Okay, and now you're here for Antonioni. So so do you just have a thing for 20-something malcontents?
Yes, you know, I mean, I'm recently in my 30s, so I'm not so far removed from 20-something malcontent myself.
Sure. I hear you. I am really grateful that you've taken this up as your brand.
Someone's got to stand by it.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, so this will actually come in handy because for our second topic, we're going to compliment Antonioni's mid-century existential malaise with some examples of our favorite contemporary tales of urban isolation and unhappiness. Woo!
Party time.
And then, woo!
My favorite.
And then, lastly, we'll close things out with some final notes of positivity. I have a feeling we're going to need it. All right. You guys ready to stare longingly at strange geometric shapes?
Only if I'm leaning against a wall.
Right. All right, let's do it. First up, we have Michelangelo Antonioni's 1962 film, L'Eclisse, the third installment in the unofficial Sickness of Eros trilogy. L'Eclisse has Antonioni mainstay Monica Vitti playing Vittoria, a young woman fresh out of a long-term relationship with a considerably older man. The film opens the night after their breakup, just as they're saying their goodbyes. Well, Vittoria is saying goodbye. The older man is begging her to stay, to no avail. But after the old man finally leaves, Vittoria sulks around her apartment, commiserates with some friends, and finally decides to confide in her mother over the breakup. Her mother, it turns out, is a gambling addict, though of the socially sanctioned variety. She spends her days at the Rome Stock Exchange, where she prays and chants to the gods of finance that the market go her way. When Vittoria stops into the exchange, she comes upon her mother's stockbroker, Piero, who's played by French film icon Alain Delon. Did I say that right? Yeah, I'm sure I did. Vitti and Delon, being two of the most perfect physical specimens of humanity, naturally proceed on a courtship. Only love isn't necessarily in the cards for these two. This is an Antonioni movie, after all. Their romance disintegrates, in part because Vittorio finds Piero's line of work shallow and materialistic, but also because in Antonioni's depiction of post-war Italy, the individual has no purpose beyond the routine of daily existence, Nothing, not love, not family, not friendship, yields any kind of genuine connection. And so, despite their mutual attraction, Vittoria and Piero can't seem to invest the emotional energy that's required for loving another person. Instead, they walk around the city, staring blankly at Rome's vestigial traces of fascism and its newly built modern structures, wandering, dislocated from time and space, and feeling utterly alone. By the time of L'Eclisse's release, the emptiness of modern existence was well-worn territory for Antonioni. His previous two entries in the Eros trilogy also follow attractive people feeling alienated from society and each other. And each film is bold and uncompromising in its narrative conceits and slow pacing. That said, L'Eclisse stands out among the three as the most formally innovative. I suppose one of you can contest that if you like. In its final act, it all but abandons its narrative in favor of impressionistic images of cityscapes, rusted street lamps, malfunctioning sprinkler systems, babies in strollers, all come together to form Antonioni's final word on this series. The meaning remains open for interpretation, but let's see if today's panel can make heads or tails of it. All right, Scott, I'm going to pick on you again.
Do it.
Prior to our recording, you were very excited about coming on to discuss this film, which frankly seems kind of antithetical to the whole series. but I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad you're here to bring the excitement. So tell us why L'Eclisse?
I don't know. Why not L'Eclisse? I feel
why
like
not?
You're all going to tell me this is secretly a terrible film when I think it's quite brilliant. I don't know. I agree with you that of the three kind of loosely defined trilogy, you know, I mean, Red Desert fits in just as well with the three as anything else.
Sure.
Only it's in color, I guess.
Right.
But of those initial three, it is definitely the most formally adventurous. You know, there are shots, even the opening shot of the film, which is of a bookcase and a lamp. We're not quite sure why we're looking at it or what purpose it could serve. And then we discover there's an arm leaning in there. You know, there's all these shots that are kind of constantly dislocating us from the environment, from each other, from the space around us. There's this whole notion throughout the film of Antonio's familiar alienation theme, but not just amongst people, but amongst their world. You know, it almost starts to feel like a science fiction movie at times. There's these streets that are like impossibly abandoned with maybe like one person creepily walking down it, and he really emphasizes the sound of each footstep along the way. Yeah, I mean, I suppose I'm rambling a little bit here, but it's a
no.
film that spurs a lot of thought, I guess, in a lot of different directions because it is so ununified in a way that Antonioni would get even more so throughout his career. But I think this is the start of a really exciting phase in it, even if it is kind of categorically viewed as the end of one phase.
Mm, yeah. All right, Martin.
Oh, no.
Your turn.
It's tough because, like, I think there's probably not another filmmaker of Antonioni's stature that I connect with as little as I do.
Fair,
but
fair.
Like, I can admire it. Like, I understand there's like an artistry there. I see the abstraction of those environments. I think that's very interesting. Or his abstractions of his actors, the emotional abstraction, the alienation. Like, I understand it's there. And I think, like, if Antonioni was a photographer, like, maybe he'd be one of my favorites. I'd have the giant coffee table book. But it's, you know, it's difficult to find anything of substance or emotional depth or anything about human nature. And it sort of feels like a film that actively rebuffs you from investing in it, or maybe even punishes you for trying to empathize, which I understand that's the name of the game. But it's not... it's not really a film that speaks to me, and it's sort of too bad because, like, it is a film that I know inspired filmmakers who I really admire and respect and connect with, and it resembles films that I feel very strongly about. So I can understand, you know, when I'm trying to explain why I like some film and a person's rolling their eyes at me, it's probably the same as you know, an Antonioni fan trying to explain it to me. But that's sort of where I'm coming from.
That's totally fair. And I mean, you're now on record as feeling lukewarm on Antonioni. Are you comfortable with that?
They're going to come with their pitchforks.
They are. No.
The famously angered Antonioni fans.
The dispassionate, angry crowd.
Yes. Quick to anger. Anyway.
That's scary.
It's true. yeah, they'll just resent you, but they'll never tell you.
Exactly.
Until I'm okay with that. 5 years down the road. Yeah.
That's fine by me.
All right. Well, I think we have one more person on the panel, and I just want a quick second to just preface Lily's remarks by saying, well, maybe I should let you tell the story. Lily, tell us the story of how you came to watch Les Eclipses.
Antonioni has been on my list for a very long time. I am a film student, so I obviously knew about him, but I hadn't actually watched him. And so I decided to just sit down and watch the entire trilogy in a row.
Yeah.
Because I had a day. So I'm still recovering from that. Yeah. But I don't know.
Are you able to distinguish one film from another?
Yes.
Do they kind of bleed into each other? Okay.
I think I can distinguish between one and the other. I don't think I'll get anyone too confused. I've got names ready.
Okay, okay.
I will say this was my least favorite of the trilogy.
Okay.
But I'm really enjoying hearing the summaries and the breakdowns. It's like helping, like, I get it more now.
Okay, yeah.
Than I probably did when I was watching it.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, L'Avventura is probably my favorite.
Okay, all right. well, I guess for me, I had seen this many years ago when I first watched L'Avventura. And listeners can go back and listen to the L'Avventura episode. I can't vouch for its quality. It was a long time ago. But, you know, if you're interested. We had a really good guest, Bill Crone. But I remember feeling... I don't remember loving this one. But upon this rewatch, I did start to kind of gel with it a little bit more. And I think, Scott, something you said, you mentioned it's almost, it has sci-fi elements. And when I started to see it through that lens, it became much more interesting. Mm-hmm. And so I just kind of pictured the protagonist as kind of not human. And I think that helped me get into the story a little bit more. These are not people I'm meant to relate to necessarily. They are beings of some sort trying to find their way in this weird sort of Earth-like place and sort of not relating to their surroundings at all. And just the way that they use their, particularly, both of them use this kind of their physical beauty to kind of enhance the idea that they are not of this world, right? It works in that regard. Also, just the scene where they're wrestling on the couch and they don't know what to do with their arms, right? Like, there's something, like, they spend the entire film just kind of perplexed by their own forms. And just the end way VT walks, she doesn't walk like a normal person, she kind of glides. And Delon, he looks like a little boy in an oversized suit. You know, there's just so much that just doesn't quite connect with anything that I know about people. And so just having that experience and getting and watching them in this world, I thought was actually kind of fascinating. And trying to learn how to be human and kind of failing. So I looked at it as kind of a Star Trek episode, albeit a really, really, one of the more experimental episodes, to be sure.
Oh, I mean, it's funny because like that film Under the Skin that came out recently.
I was
like,
just thinking that. Right,
right. Borrowed a lot from Antonioni, like the walking right into the fog looks a lot like Identification of a Woman. So like I could see somebody taking those elements and arranging them into something science fiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you thought of Star Trek, and I sort of thought of The Twilight Zone. It's almost like this scenario where, you know, sometime before the film took place, most of the world, like, fell extinct or something, and there's just this small group of people who are like damned to play the stock market for all eternity, and right. that's like the only yeah. thing they can get excited about. They can't get excited about each other or sex or even you know the money they end up making. They just get excited about the room and the game. But I mean, I think what you said about them relating to themselves and their own bodies, I think that's part of why I find this film fairly effective on an emotional level. I don't know. I feel like we're all kind of learning how to be human one day at a time. Maybe that's just me. And I think the awkwardness they experience and the you joked earlier about kind of the Antonioni fans, you know, kind of looking down on the non-fans and not saying anything about it for them for years. Mm-hmm. But that is not an unfamiliar emotion to me either. And so maybe I relate to it a lot on the level of kind of waspy guy who grew up holding in a lot of emotion.
That's perfect.
It's funny because you referenced that arm scene, and I really like your general thesis, but for me the arm scene was almost the most human scene of the entire movie, because it was like they were actually laughing at something. It was awkward, and it kind of for me was like they were actually almost breaking character in that one.
Interesting.
Even the way they even the way they laugh though almost seems inhuman. There's something kind of performative about their embarrassment.
Yeah, especially VT, like, there's something, she just breaks, it seems very abrupt, her laughter.
Yeah.
She's laughing, and then she's not.
Well, like, both of them have such a naturally cool persona that, like, it's hard to imagine either of them, like, laughing for real at all, you know? Like, it almost feels like it has to be a performance, because both of them, you know, in other films, they always come across, like, very cool, emotionally cool, and... I mean, that's funny you mentioned before about the stock market, like that scene, he's cheering and excited. And then like the next scene, Alain Delon, he's just that like stone face coming out and interacting with her. So it's like an interesting juxtaposition.
Yeah. Well, I guess the one thing that this film is probably best known for, and Antonioni in general, is the pacing. So I'm curious how, well, specifically Lily, I guess, because that's got to be at least 7 hours of Antonioni, six and a half hours of Antonioni. So what was that experience like? Because this is not Transformers, you know.
No, you know, it actually, for all the joking, it sounds a lot more exhausting than it actually was. Maybe I was taking a super relaxed approach to it. It did make, I think, the disjointed structure of L'Eclisse a little more expected, since I was getting used to it with La Ventura and La Notte. But it also, it was kind of cool because you got the connecting themes as well, and I'm sure we'll get to the themes in a second. But I think pacing-wise, it definitely, it was patient, but it wasn't like, I didn't feel like he wasn't moving along. Maybe a little bit in the middle of this one, it was getting a little lagging a bit, but it also made the ending with the nuclear imagery and stuff kind of a little more jarring and shocking. Mm. Like, oh wait, that's what you were talking about this whole time. but yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, well, I'm glad if you can get into the rhythm of it. It's not too bad.
7 hours of Transformers would be more exhausting.
That's probably true. Yeah. Well, okay. So you mentioned themes, and I think we're kind of all dancing around, or we're kind of getting into it. But I gather that this film means different things to different people. It does lend itself to multiple interpretations. I guess, Martin, what do you think the movie's about?
I sort of took it as a film about nothingness. You know, it's not a film about, oh, that movie's not about anything, but I think it's sort of about the emptiness inside people, inside the culture, maybe. I mean, there's a lot of other themes that people sort of read into and pick up on, and I think, like, I don't know if it's ambiguous so much as inscrutable, so, like, I think it does lend itself to people kind of hanging themes onto it, but for me, that's what I took away from it, was just the spaces in between people, the blocking out of the light, the eclipse, you know, it's this emptiness, nothingness.
Right. Yeah. Scott?
I mean, I think Martin hit it on the head, especially the idea that we can all kind of read into it what we like. And I think the thing I read into it most is just the the desperation of living in a point in society in which emotional connections aren't valued. You know, I think the foregrounding of money is very important to the film, and I think Antonioni was really considering the effect of which the new influx of cash at this point in Italian society was having on society at large, and just the idea that, you know, they're all kind of chasing after some ultimate goal, mostly just kind of to win, it seems like. The stock market isn't really so much about enriching one's life as it is just, I mean, I think you were right in that it is about the gambling, the rush of gambling, and how that then leaves people, you know, unable to express themselves, but also whatever they have to express to one another, they're afraid to put out there and afraid of giving too much of themselves to one another for fear that could jeopardize whatever value they have.
Right. Yeah. And Lily, you mentioned that there's also kind of less subtle references to the nuclear arms race. Yeah. There are a handful of contemporary hot button issues, or contemporary for the time, that he addresses in a sort of less than ambiguous way. Yeah. That's probably the most the least subtle part of the movie. Yeah. And I'm of course talking about the scene. I'm talking about the ending with the flashes of the newspaper about the nuclear arms race, but also the scene where Monica Vitti dons blackface and does an African dance. I don't know. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, this is not meant to be. He's not celebrating her doing this, right? I think it's a critique.
Possibly.
But I don't know. I mean, possibly, right. Yeah. Yeah. True. Yeah. Go ahead, Martin.
I think it's hard to say what's being said about it because it's not really something that's elaborated on too much. The closest you get to the sense that it's a critique is later on. She's walking past these black men later in the film, and she just looks a little bit uncomfortable, and you can kind of connect that back, that, like, you know, maybe she's ashamed for doing that or embarrassed or, you know, find something in it. But it's kind of hard to say what the actual critique is, other than, you know, maybe rich people are racist or something, you know, as basic like that. Like,
yeah,
it's kind of like this film, you know, in a few ways, it reminded me of a Story of a 3-Day Pass, which we covered on the podcast a while ago, which was all about being alienated in the city and meeting up with somebody and, you know, not being sure how deeply you connect with them. And it has this ambiguous ending also, but they have such different approaches to the human experience. Like, I think Story of a 3-Day Pass is like a really definite, you know, even though it's subtle and there's layers of ambiguity, it's saying very definite things about race and love and humanity. And I think, like, one thing that I have trouble with in Iglesias is it's hard to get an idea that's definite. And, you know, I know it's, again, I think it's by design, but it's sort of nebulous, whatever these themes are, how they brush up against each other, how they're interconnected. So it's hard to say for sure.
I mean, even the ending, right? You have bits and pieces of things. You're not really sure how they're meant to connect.
Did anyone else feel like just like a little bit jerked around when you have the blonde woman walking and you think, like, oh, maybe it could be Monica Vitti, and then it turns around and it's not? Like, you know, that felt like a little bit mean, the point. You know? I don't know. Do you think that, you know, it sort of makes it difficult to get on this film's wavelength, stuff like that, where, you know, you feel like, oh, like, you thought this movie had something to do with something we showed you before? No, like, forget it. Like, you know, is there an easier way to broach that? Or is that just something you have to deal with if you like Antonioni?
I think that's kind of what keeps me on its wavelength, though, is that it keeps kind of upending and upsetting itself. There's no kind of definitive through line that, I mean, as kind of scattershot as Love and Tour can be in a way, in terms of, you know, abandoning the protagonist 30 minutes into the movie, it's more conventionally narrative. It almost has like a film noir structure short of an actual resolution. But this is so disassociated and so, you know, I mean, from one scene to the next, you have no idea what's going to happen. I think that's very intriguing. And it's also, I think, the first film Antonioni made that can only be a film. You know, there's no other form in which this could exist.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. It's an interesting idea.
It's an...
Why... So why do you think... do you think La Notte could be made as a television... I mean, or I mean, some other...
La Notte is almost like a stage play, at least from what I recall. I've only seen it the once, but it's very... It's more directly confrontational in terms of the characters and their actions and emotions. Sure.
Yeah, that's true.
A lot more conversation.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. What were you going to say?
Well, I was just thinking about... I remember, like, being obviously horrified at the blackface scene as I was trying to figure out what his goals were with that. And one thing I was thinking about is, like, Cleese in general is kind of cruder than La Ventura La Notte specifically. And I was kind of noting how the protagonist, you kind of, La Ventura, you get this very elitist group, including the princess and everyone. And then La Notte, you have that privileged class, but you also have an intellectual, and there's a lot of conversation about him being an intellectual. And so I just think there's this possibly class commentary going on.
Yeah, it is interesting. I often think because of the other films that Monica Vitti is more... more of an heiress in this film than, but she's just the daughter of essentially a fairly poor mother, and her father was dead at this point, or has left a picture. I can't remember.
Yeah, I think he died.
Yeah, so there's no, you know, she doesn't have the same level of privilege, but I think the blackface scene shows that she still feels herself, I don't know, dominant in some way, or above another culture. You know, it's kind of maybe a way of punching down, if you want to look at it that way. But at any rate, I mean, I think this scene, no matter where she's coming from, just shows the how disassociated one world can be from another when you don't have the direct experience of it, you know. And there's the woman whose apartment they're visiting, who I think is pretty clearly uncomfortable with how they're behaving. You know, she kind of laughs along at first, but before long is kind of looking off in the distance and says, you know, I don't think we should be playing this anymore. But then, you know, moments later, she's calling them monkeys. So even she, you know, who has lived in Africa and has the direct experience of the people, has taken it upon herself to feel superior to them. And I think that's another way in which the film kind of, you know, gives you a moment of comfort. You're like, oh, thank God, somebody's saying something about this. But then she turns out to be just as bad as the others.
Right, yeah. Right. This film is unrelenting. And it's just, people are really awful. No one gets a pass. If not awful, then... I mean, they fail time and time again.
Yeah.
So, let's see. So, well, again, we've sort of been touching on the La Ventura, La Notte, and the Eclipse, the various differences between the three. But let's talk about the ways in which they are similar. One very obvious common thread throughout the three is that Monica Vitti is in all of three of them. What do you think of her performance in this versus the previous two? Obviously, she's playing a very different character in La Notte, or is she? her role is a little different in that one. But how does her performance in this compare to the previous two? I kind of feel like she's doing her Monica Vitti thing in all three, and it's used to different effects in each.
I think this one she's given kind of more free range, partially because the film is so, as we've said, kind of, it's less formed and less purpose driven. So you see her roots as a comedian, I think, come out a little bit more, not in that, like, her performance in blackface is particularly funny because it's clearly offensive, but the kind of looseness she has in that scene, and then a couple others where she's just like making faces and stuff, and she has kind of a freedom, or when she's actually, I always watch the movies when we're podcasting about them, so I have the film on my screen right now, and when she's like coaxing the dogs in the street, she's very kind of friendly and free with them in a way that I don't think we've seen in the last two films.
I don't know. What I mean, as someone who mainlined them, what do you think, Lily?
I was thinking about that. I feel like she starts out the trilogy more grounded than she does in the second two. Like, obviously she makes weird decisions in La Ventura, but at least in the beginning of it, she seems actually fairly normal, and actually more normal than her best friend and her future lover. And then La Notte, she's kind of got the crazy heiress thing going on, where she's dancing around, playing with the checkerboard and things like that. So it's almost like she kind of, I feel like she gets less and less mature throughout the series.
Yeah, totally.
Interesting sort of way.
Yeah, devolving.
I don't know what that means, but I think that's the common thread I saw.
Nothing good. Martin, how about you?
I'm not sure if I have much to add. I think like you're right. Like she does become more, and in a way, she becomes more abstracted. Like probably Lenote. It's like
Lenote. I know. I'm saying it so wrong.
I mean, that's probably closer to naturalism than this. Like, there's some parts that sort of seem naturalistic, but then they oscillate with that very sort of like icy performative stuff. Like, I mean, do you want to discuss what the character even is? Like, who is this character?
That's true. Yeah, we barely know anything about her beyond she's some sort of interpreter or translator. And she has a mother and a father who died. And that's about it. And she's very, very pretty. yeah, beyond that, and she's very sad. Did I miss anything?
I was wondering, like, do you think the character's maybe depressed, or do you think, like, you sort of mentioned in the introduction this idea that the gambling on the stock market had a role in why she doesn't stick with Alain Delon's character, but like it starts with her breaking up with the first relationship. You know, is it something in that character that can't, that doesn't want to stay with somebody but still seeks them out? Or like I sort of wonder, I mean, that's, I don't know, like, to what extent maybe the character is sort of key in understanding what the film is, or I don't know, what do you guys think?
I think you're also right, Martin. Like, she is as inscrutable as the film, right? So you can try and guess either way. I mean, you're also right that maybe it was my own distaste for the character that led me to think that.
I mean, that she could be the case too. I'm not sure, but
it's interesting because I keep talking about like her breaking up with him because she doesn't like his job. I took a lot of the kind of breaking up and getting back together as almost like sex games in a weird sort of way. I took it as like a flirtation.
Interesting.
There would be juxtapositions where they'd break up and then the next scene they'd be pursuing each other again.
So, that's true.
And since there's kind of sexual tension in all three of these, I took that as kind of more just dysfunctional flirtation.
I don't know. What do you think, Scott?
I mean, I hate to keep going back to my same talking point, but the inscrutability is such the pleasure of the film to me, and that we can't get a permanent read on her. I think because I'd seen Love and Tour before this, I kind of brought associations to her role here that, you know, the more we're kind of talking out, maybe are unearned. But, you know, I think there's a similar kind of unnamed dissatisfaction driving it, where she has, you know, even if she doesn't have as much money at her disposal here, she has similar unusual opportunities, you know, like riding around on an airplane or bumming around the stock market or any of the other kind of things she does to pass the time. You know, she is so divorced from the idea of work, it's hard to believe she has a job at all. But the opportunities she's afforded just aren't, you know, as satisfying as she seems to think she should tell people they are. You know, she's constantly kind of projecting this idea of happiness and smiling and telling people she's having a good time, or that she's kind of non-verbally communicating her satisfaction while internally trying to figure out why she's unsatisfied by it all.
Well, and it's not unlike the mother in the whore. In fact, it's kind of the inverse of the mother in the whore, right? Like, those characters just talk and talk and talk,
right,
and don't really say anything. These people, Monica Vitti, can't even be bothered to say anything, right? Like, can't be bothered to fill the silence. But the end is the same. There's just emptiness. But I don't know. I guess in some regard it does. It's interesting. And I think maybe we'll talk about this more in the second topic, because I don't know that kind of sad white people are really like all that in fashion anymore. But yeah, there's something about it that feels very of its time. I guess I'll say that. But at the same time, this sci-fi element really makes it feel kind of out of time. It could be anywhere. This is so I think it works on both levels. It works as kind of a time capsule, but it also bears such little resemblance to anything that anyone has experienced that it kind of builds its own world. And so I think it succeeds in that and in both those regards.
Yeah, the notion of it falling out of fashion, I'm glad you mentioned that because I do feel, I mean, when I was first like getting into movies 10, 12 years ago, Antonioni was very in fashion. And, you know, I started to discover his films around the time he died, and the way people were talking about him was like so ecstatic, and how he kind of, you know, got at the root of society man or whatever you want to say. But sure. I think the idea of like the sad white person film, as much as it has fallen out of fashion, I think it tends to come back in fashion during boom economic times, which Italy was experiencing when he was making exactly. these films, and which, you know, for all it's worth, America was experiencing, you know, kind of then and in the decade previous. And it turned out its own share of sad white people films during sure, that time as well. Sure. And yeah. there's a reason, I think, then that it would be also in fashion, you know, around the time I was getting into movies, you know, the mid-2000s, you know, things were still going well economically. And while there was, it's, you know, we had their own sort of political or social strife at the time, the idea was that, you know, the country was in good shape and could kind of reflect on itself and didn't have to address, you know, moment-to-moment problems. And I think the more right. those problems kind of arise, the less we're willing to endure these kind of more existential concerns. For better or worse, you know, I totally get why he's kind of less regarded now than he was then. But, you know, his time may yet come back around if we can find peace again.
Fingers crossed. Ay, ay, ay. Okay, well, we'll save that for the next topic. But let's close things out with the final question. This is the 73rd film on the Sight and Sound Critics Poll. Is it worthy of the 73rd spot? Just a reminder to everyone, it is tied with The Grand Illusion, The Third Man, Children of Paradise, and Nashville. Good spot for it? What do you think? Let's start with Martin.
Oh my god.
I know, sorry. Sorry to do that to you.
well, I mean, that's kind of... This is second highest Antonioni film on the list, right?
Yes.
I feel like it's always a little bit easier to be hard on a filmmaker once they've already had a film on the Sight and Sound list. But,
sure, yeah.
I don't know, it's tough for me to say because like I do recognize what it is. And like I think a lot of the reasons why I can say I might dislike it are the exact same reasons Scott might like it a lot. You know, so it's hard for me to say. I guess I'm kind of okay-ish with it being on the list. I wouldn't really put it this high up, but that's just me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair. Lily, how about you? What do you think?
You know, I definitely think we were discussing how the fact that La Notte is not even on the list, and I definitely preferred La Notte to this one. As in terms of Antonioni himself, like, regardless of the thematics, some of this is just stunningly beautiful to watch. And the fact that he is kind of experimenting and playing with narrative like he does, I think for me, and it's successful enough to merit being on the list, but I think I'd prefer La Notte. And then also in terms of like, it's been a long time since I've seen it, but I prefer Grand Illusion. I think that it shouldn't be tied with Grand Illusion at all. I think Grand Illusion should be above. So yeah, I think I'm not horrified that it's this high up, but I would put it lower or okay. replace it with La Notte.
Well, it's okay. Red Desert's right. also on the list, right?
Red Desert is on the list, a little further down, but
Maybe Red Desert swapping places with it, or I don't know.
Fine.
I'm just throwing that out there.
That's yeah. Okay. Well, Scott, it's your turn. Give us, I assume 73 is either good or too low.
Sure, like seems that. Fine. I think I also seems prefer fun. Red Desert by a hair okay. as well, for what it's worth. But I mean, these are all pretty estimable films, and I think it kind of pairs well, especially with The Third Man in Nashville. I think they're exploring kind of similar emotional spaces. But I think they're all exceptional films, and they all deserve mention alongside one another.
All right, all right. Well, I guess I'm going to leave it there. I like that. All right, welcome back, everyone. So, as I mentioned in the previous segment, as I was doing research for Les Cris, I noted that many articles on the film included some variation on the sentiment that Antonioni films are now considered unfashionable or outmoded. But their initial talk about the ebbs and flows of film fashion got me to thinking about whether or not a more contemporary depiction of existential cinema exists, and how and why it might differ from the modes that were popular in the 1960s. So, that's a big topic. Gracious. Okay. But so let's sort of ease our way into it. I know, Scott, I'm going to kind of jump off from what you were saying about Antonioni and why he's kind of unfashionable at the moment. So Antonioni, I think it's fair to say, is emblematic of a particular kind of existential despair, one that's deeply rooted in mid-century post-war ennui. But how has our approach to portraying urban isolation and modernity changed over the years? Obviously, modernity means something very different now than it did in the 1960s. So, I mean, this sort of invites, this is pre-MTV. We could go that route. So I'm just kind of curious what you guys think of this prompt in the first place. Like, what came to your mind initially?
Yeah, I think initially I started to think about the way cities have changed and the way culture has changed, especially around, I mean, it's inevitable, technology and smartphones and apps and all the ways we relate to each other that have changed now. But also I think in cinema that's been reflected through a tighter focus on genre, you know, in some ways we already mentioned Under the Skin, which is an overtly science fiction film that kind of gets at similar emotional space as Les Cris. And then I also thought of, from earlier this year, Personal Shopper, the Olivier Assayas film, that is also a ghost story, and which is also kind of about a young woman living at the on the fringes of a high society life, but not really finding any satisfaction from it. In other ways, I think someone like Hong Sang-soo gets at sort of the disconnect without making it overtly about technology while still kind of addressing the same way in which people live kind of together but apart from one another. Yeah, those three kind of came to mind right away. I think more loosely, yeah, you could say that Terrence Malick has kind of taken on a greater focus with this kind of subject with his last couple of films, more so Night of Cups and To the Wonders. Song to Song is kind of more overtly romantic.
Although Song to Song, did you think of Les Cris during the airplane scene?
No,
when she's,
no, you're totally right, though.
Looking out the window.
Yeah.
I mean, there is sort of a similarity, like the Rooney Mara character. One thing I really liked in Song to Song was her, I forget what the line is exactly, but she says something like, you know, I was embarrassed to say I had a soul. Like, I thought the word was embarrassing or something like that, you know, and it's sort of this idea of being maybe too aloof to feel things or be invested in the emotions that are maybe right in front of you. You could maybe say it fits in, like, her character in some ways, it's maybe not so different from the Christian Bale character in Knight of Cups or...
Yeah,
maybe.
Mm-hmm. I think you're totally right. I think to me, because Song to Song ends in a more romantic note, I kind of think, yeah, of them apart.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get that. So it's interesting you bring up Knight of Cups because I had that sensation while I was watching it that this is sort of a kind of an outmoded way of showing exactly what that movie is about. Like, it felt very kind of Antonioni light in a way, or like a sort of carbon copy-ish. I know you're a big fan. I was not. So that stipulated that. I mean, maybe that was why it felt sort of dated a little bit. which is maybe unfair. But what can I say? No kind of attention span. these iPhones, you know.
Well, it's funny too. Like the whole idea of this, all the modernity, the ennui that goes along with that. Like, it's funny reading. I love a lot of books and stories and biographies from 1920s, you know, or between the world wars. Like, how similar life feels and people's complaining feels. Like, I have to work this apartment job and trying to meet this girl, and we'll go out and see a movie. And it you know, it's Kafka's biography or somebody like that, you know. Like, I think in some ways it hasn't changed that much. And you can go and watch a film like Lonesome, which, you know, like, it's not a big existential film. It's like the, you know, early musical with color from 1920s. But like the basic idea of feeling alienated in this environment where you're surrounded by all these people, like, you know, I think that's still something you can relate to. It doesn't feel so distant, you know. Maybe some things have changed, but I think what's changed might be a little bit superficial.
Yeah, it could be.
It's funny thinking about all these. I just realized, you know, I'm not an ennui fan. It's just like not my emotion of choice. Dig. Yeah. But I was thinking, oddly enough, of like, well, not oddly, because it actually, like, Mad Men was what I was thinking of, things that gone out of fashion. And I think as much as I absolutely adore Mad Men, there's this element of you're self-sabotaging, you have so much going on, what are you doing? And I just kind of want to scream at him. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a bit of that in Antonioni as well, this kind of idea that there are so much bigger problems. And I'm like, I don't know. The other one I thought of was like Frances Ha, where she's kind of like gliding around New York in kind of a millennial haze.
Right.
Where as much as I enjoyed it, you still have that kind of like, there are bigger things.
Sure. Yeah. No, those are two prime examples. It's particularly Mad Men, because that is mid-century. So it makes sense that there would be this connection to this, you know, the roughly the same time period as Antonioni.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I can't remember if What's-His-Face has ever cited Antonioni as an influence. I don't think
so. No, I think he has. And in fact,
has he? Yeah.
The series name checks La Notte during the second season.
Oh, is that when they go to Italy?
No, it's actually he and Bobby Barrett are driving around. It's right before they get in an accident, and they're talking about movies, and she's like, oh, especially the European ones, they're so sexy. And he just all smoothly goes, La Notte. And she's like, oh, La Notte.
Nice. That's amazing.
Perfect. Yeah. I mean, but Frances Ha is a great example of a contemporary one that I think is pretty, it's self-aware. Like, yeah. I think it doesn't treat her problems like they're the biggest problems in the world, but they are typical of someone her age, and that sort of her angst isn't so much rooted in the larger world. Yeah. I mean, I suppose in a different decade, she would have had to have been married and not had to worry a pretty little head about finding a job or anything like that. But so the economics of the situation have changed, but the specificity of the kind of existential shift when you have a really, really close friend and suddenly they like, that's a profound change in your life, in the life of a young person. And so I guess maybe what filmmakers today are doing, and they're sort of orienting their angst around more specific elements of unhappiness, right? As opposed to humans, they're miserable, aren't they? They're just the worst. And I wonder if we will start to see a shift more towards this kind of nihilism of Antonioni. Maybe that's too far to say that he's nihilistic, because he clearly reveres Viti. Like, there's something about, he puts her on a pedestal. But I think there is a streak of like, aren't humans the worst? Mm-hmm. And I think we may start to see that crop up a bit.
Yeah.
I don't know.
For some reason, the only movie I can think of right now is like The Lobster, which goes into science fiction as well.
Right. Yeah.
I feel like we are in an age, and like age being like a year, mm-hmm. where it's just, I feel like we're being so much more emotive, both in life and in movies. Like, mm-hmm. I keep thinking about like the scene in The Big Sick where she's screaming at him and he's like, "You're a therapist. Aren't you supposed to deal with these things better?" And she's like, "I'm expressing myself." And it's the opposite, obviously, in Antonioni, and I feel like it's more on that end of the spectrum now.
Mm. We've all been through the ringer with the head shrinkers, yeah. So we understand.
We talk about
yeah, things. We talk about things now.
We don't wait till we fall out of love,
right?
For no reason at
exactly,
all.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, so should we just, do you guys have a top five list of contemporary, top five seems like too arbitrary, but I just think if there are good places to start, as far as, if you're someone, a young person today, and you're feeling like, I could dig some what does it all mean movies, mm-hmm. do you have any suggestions? Scott, do you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'll reiterate the ones I already mentioned. Personal Shopper and Knight sure. of Cups. Any Hong Sang-soo movie you can get your hands on, which are unfortunately relatively few in America at this time, but hopefully there will be more. Also, Marinata's, her last film, but her one before that, Everyone Else, is a really exceptional film about the difficulty of modern relationships and all that. And also Chantal Ackerman's last film, No Home Movie, which is a documentary technically, but is so formally familiar, I think, for people who have seen Antonioni, and so emotionally similar in terms of the difficulty of relating one another. And it has actually a very similar ending now that I think about it.
You're right. Oh my, yes. I was nodding my head vigorously, and then I suddenly stopped. You're right. I think yes. And I totally second that. I'm glad I was not the first to mention Ackerman. Anyway, Martin, you got any more suggestions?
I know, I'm not good at this. I'm happy and well-adjusted. I don't know. I think people might want to check out Tsai Ming-liang's films. He's sort of retired now, but like maybe Rebels of a Neon God might fit in. Maybe Jim Jarmusch, even.
Mm,
I don't know if
yeah.
people have seen Patterson. It's sort of, there's a little bit of the creative anxiety, and I could see that. I don't know, what about Theo Angelopoulos, like Ulysses Gaze? Would that be a good one for people?
Sure.
Sure. or you know who might be good is Kiyoshi Kurosawa's films, like Pulse, maybe. Like that's a horror film, but you know, if we're talking about modern life and anxiety and existential dread, that's a good one. Or who else would be good? Maybe Sharanas Bartas films, like The House. It's sort of...
Oh, okay.
I don't... have you seen The House?
I have not.
I think he's probably better known for A Few of Us. He has a new film this year I really want to see. But The House I like, because it's just sort of the big empty house, and it's a little bit like an Antonioni film.
Sure.
You know, if you like people standing up against interesting textured walls, that's a good film for that. Maybe another one would be the Criterion film they released recently, The Swamp from Argentina, the Lucrecia Martel film.
I know nothing about it.
Oh, it's the pool's a metaphor. It's filthy.
All right. Well, I think that's a lot of angst for someone who's so liar. Lily, I know you said angst is not, or ennui is not really your bag. I guess I should say Lily has come to Madison. By the way, I moved to Madison. But Lily has come here in the hopes of studying animation with an emphasis on Disney movies.
Which is so not Antonioni.
Right. Right. But there's plenty of that in certainly in Pixar.
Yeah.
Right?
You know, I was going to hold back. You know, the most European of them is Ratatouille, and you get a bit of Not really. Yeah, you get a bit of existential dread if you read it into it. Up, you have his crisis in the beginning when everything's gray and he's figuring out how to live again. So there's some ennui in there. Wally, you get a bit of depressing world order stuff.
Yeah.
And so you can find it if you look for it. And like I guess the only ennui recommendation I could get was actually just go watch Mad Men.
Sure.
I'm trying to think if there are any good shorts that will also have existential contemplation, but none are coming to mind right now.
That's okay. Watch Mad Men. I think that's Mad Men. Like, if you haven't already.
Enjoy.
Yeah.
Tell me about the suitcase.
Exactly. all right. Well, I guess that's like roughly, I feel like listeners have a pretty good place to start. I just wanted to throw in the Soderbergh-filled side effects. It seems to come up a lot lately. I don't know why. Maybe because Soderbergh has a new movie out or whatever. But I thought that was a great example. Again, we have Mara. Oh my God, is Rooney Mara the new Monica Vitti? Putting it out.
I can dig it.
Yeah. I can see that. Quiet contemplation.
Yeah. Very angular features.
Just in that
yes.
ghost
yeah.
movie that's yes. kind of supposed to be existential
yes.
ghost story movie.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think we've just stumbled upon something. There's my new dissertation. Thank you very much.
You're set.
Yeah.
Got this.
Yeah. Anyway, okay. That's a good place to leave it. That's enough existential dread for one show. Let's change the pace for
I'm not
just
sure
one
I feel
second.
Up to it
yeah, you're gonna have to summon some energy. Here we go. We're gonna end things on some positive notes. Martin, what's one movie, song, book, kitchen utensil that's making you feel secure in your personhood?
I've been playing the Dark Souls video games, which don't exactly fill me with traditional joy, but they're very engaging, rewarding. They're kind of like Legend of Zelda by way of Marketa Lazarova. They're full of empty spaces, and they're kind of they have a reputation for being really difficult, but I'm not somebody who plays video games often, and I'm not having too much trouble. I finished the second one, now I'm playing the first one right now in whatever free time I can scrape together. But I really like the atmosphere and all the design work. The level designs are really fantastic, all the creatures and armor and stuff like that. It's a fun time for me, I guess.
All right. I don't know. I'm not sure you filled the mandate, but... But hopefully Scott can get us back on the right track. Scott, positivity, no darkness.
No, certainly not. I've been really getting into Blondie lately, but I know I'm very late to the party.
Yes!
So I know me recommending Blondie to anyone is like
perfect thing.
Besides the point. Because everyone else knows how great Blondie is, and it's only me who just figured mm-hmm. it out. So I do also want to
welcome to the party, Scott.
I do also want to throw some love to Arrow Video's recent release of the Taisho trilogy by Seijun Suzuki. I recently
they're so good.
Saw the first film in that Zigenerverson, which is incredible. It's one of the best films I've seen in a very, 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 very long time. And so I highly recommend people do a blind buy on that one. I've seen Kagurozawa about a year ago. Love that one too. I think it's totally worthwhile.
I second that. That's a great set.
All right, those are excellent suggestions. That's exactly what we need, Lily.
I promise mine's positive, but I thought it was kind of hilarious that you said no darkness.
Yeah, God, what is wrong with you people?
Because I am about halfway through for the first time Ursula K. Le Guin's The Left Hand of Darkness, and it's amazing. It's really relevant in a sad sort of way, but it's also, if you haven't heard of it, it deals with a society without gender, which is really cool, but there's also a dictator, which has some interesting relevance. And then Lady P and I I had the shocking realization like 5 minutes before we started recording that it was written in 1969. I thought it was much later, and so I was just really impressed by that. And then I will always throw out a shout out to Parks and Rec, because that was how I got through Antonioni. I just sneak in a little Leslie Knope in between.
I like it. That's the perfect sunny, positive note that we need. Thank you. I've been moving a lot lately.
No.
Yeah. And so I haven't had a super lot of time to indulge in lots of other cultural experiences. However, the first week I got to Madison, we got a notice about an underground film screening. And there were some, I know, it was quite literally underground. And it's just basically a bunch of film nerds and, well, two film nerds who happen to have a stash of lots of really cool experimental 16mm films from, in this case, it was 1969. And so they're doing a series of it's starting in 1959 and then 69, 79, 89. Maybe there's one more because I think they're doing the 90s as well. Anyway, I arrived on 79 week and, 69, thank you. And so the one that really stood out to me is George Cukor's Hold Me While I'm Naked. I thought that was brilliant. Mm-hmm. And I believe it's available online. People can just watch it. You don't have to go to an underground film screening. But if you can, I highly recommend that as well. But basically, Cukor is this experimental filmmaker who heavily influenced John Waters. It's sort of that same weird kind of campy vibe, but with a lot of heart at the center. It also kind of reminded me of David Lynch. Maybe it was the weird stuffed bird. but there's a lot of just weird uncanniness in it and camp, and it's pretty glorious. So yeah, seek that out.
And just note, it's George Cukor, not the studio era George Cukor. Cukor,
yeah,
no, maybe confusing for half a second. For
yeah.
me.
Thank you. Yeah, that's true. Martin, do you have anything sunnier you want to talk about?
I guess not. I don't know.
I'm giving you a hard time. You're good, Martin. That was if darkness brings you joy. Then
there's a character in the game that says praise the sun, so that's a okay. plus, I guess. I don't know.
There we go. All right. Well, you're a little goth today. I love it. Anyway, here we go. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, what do you think of Leclisse? Come let us know on our website, flickswise.com. And you should also come share your thoughts on our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/flickswise. And if you think La Notte is the best film in the trilogy, then we should probably follow each other on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. But before you do all of that, please, please, go to iTunes, subscribe, rate us, and leave us a nice comment. It'll help other cinephiles find our podcast. Plus, it helps give meaning to my otherwise purposeless life. On our next show, I believe we'll be driving down the stretch of number 73. I think that's Nashville that's coming up next. But we also, and that'll be great because we're going to have Pat McGilligan on. So that's a must listen. And that'll be followed by The Third Man, The Grand Illusion, and Children of Paradise. Not sure what the order is, but so check back on social media sites for updates. Until then, Scott, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me. I miss your cozy apartment and doing this in person, but it's nice to be here nonetheless.
I know. It's good to hear your voice. I'm so sad. Scott's in Los Angeles. I'm in Madison. That's why we're getting all sentiment. Anyway, but Scott, next time maybe a comedy?
Sure.
Maybe? All right. Or not. I don't know why I'm pushing you away from this. I'm very, very happy that you like doing movies like of this sort.
I'm here for you, whatever you like.
Excellent. Excellent. Martin.
Lady P.
We made it through another one.
That's what you think.
Just barely. Not yet. Shouldn't speak too soon. It's true. All right. Oh, and by the way, Scott, I meant to ask you, do you have anything you want to plug at the moment? Any kind of Twitter handle or website?
Twitter's Rail of Tomorrow, R-A-I-L of Tomorrow. Same websites, Battleship Retention and Criterion Cast. I recently wrote about Jerry Lewis being hilarious at Battleship Retention. That's a fun thing.
Okay.
That's all I got.
That is a fun thing. All right, that's enough. Martin.
Lady B.
Where can people find you on the internet?
Here at FlixWise. Sure. And on Twitter at MovieKessler.
Okay, I guess that's
right. Good, right? Yeah.
That's perfect. Lily?
Hi.
I hope we represented ourselves well. I hope it wasn't too painful.
I had a blast.
Okay. All right. And do you want people following you on the internet?
That would be fun.
Okay.
I am at Lily, that's LILLY, Mouse26.
Mouse26. All right.
At Lily Mouse26. And I have a website. Woo! Lily Holman, HOLMAN.com. And there you can find my video blog if you want to hear about Disney movies.
As promised. Yeah. So if you're the rare subset of people that's like super into Antonioni and Disney.
Oh my gosh, yeah. We should follow each other.
Yeah.
And chat. That'd
yeah, you guys need to meet. All right. Anyway.
I just followed.
Awesome.
I was very excited.
Excellent. Yay. All right. All right. I think we've earned us a Julia Roberts movie, don't you think? Something where. Some romantic comedy, I'm thinking, where love exists and then people are good, right?
I'm trying to think.
Yeah. All right. Sure. Well, in the meantime, ciao, everyone.
Ciao.